It's in the middle of World War II, a time when nations are battling it out for power and glory. On June 8, 1941, when bombs are falling from the sky all over England, a literature professor of all people stands up and delivers one of the greatest sermons in modern history. It's a Sunday evening, and from the pulpit of the University Church of St. Mary the Virgin in Oxford, it's C.S. Lewis who gives his talk, The Weight of Glory. It's based off a New Testament passage in 2 Corinthians 4:17 that our light and momentary affliction is working for us an exceedingly greater weight of glory. You can read it online. You should. And then read it again. In it, he addresses themes of longing and desire and glory, again, in the midst of war going on. And as he begins to explore those themes of human longing and desire, he says this: if we mistake the good things of life as ends in themselves, the good things will just break our hearts. For, he says, the good things and desires of life are not things in themselves. They're only the scent of the flower we've not found, the echo of a tune we've not heard, news from a country we've never yet visited. Do you think I'm trying to weave a spell? Perhaps I am. But remember your fairy tales. Spells are used for breaking enchantments as well as for inducing them. And you and I have need of the strongest spell that can be found to wake us from the evil enchantment of worldliness, which has been upon us for nearly 100 years. Lewis says that we are under the enchantment of worldliness. And he not only warns us about this enchantment, but he wants to break us from its spell. Well, that's what's happening in the passage that we'll look at today. Would you please locate 1 John 2? If you're not familiar with the Bible, it's in the second part of the Bible. Keep turning towards the end, or there's some verses in your order of worship that we'll be looking at as well. 1 John 2. John has spent his life as a friend of Jesus, and now as an old man, he writes a letter to people like you and me. He's writing out of love for them. He's writing for their joy and their holiness and their assurance. And he's telling them there are things in this letter that work against joy and assurance, that dilute and destroy fellowship with God, that can actually deceive us. And today he's going to tell us about something else. And what is it? Friends, I think it's something so common and so ordinary that we're probably under its spell and we're not even aware of it. It's called worldliness. So let's read 1 John 2, verses 15 to 17, and I want you to listen to how John is trying to break us from the enchantment of worldliness. This is what Holy Scripture says. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride in one's possessions is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world with its lust is passing away, but the one who does the will of God remains forever. This is the word of the Lord. Well, the main point in these verses is really easy to spot. For the first time in the entire letter, John gives us a command. What is it? It's there at the beginning of verse 15. Do not love the world. Chapter 2, verse 15 is the first command in the letter, and it's the main point of the passage. What's John trying to tell us today? Don't love the world. Now, what we want to do is break this command down into four questions. What is worldliness? Or what does it mean not to love the world? What is worldliness? What does it look like? Why should we avoid it? And how do we obey this command? So those are the four questions that we're looking at today. What is it? What does it look like? Why should we avoid it? And how do we obey this command? So let's begin to try to break the spell of worldliness by asking, what is it? What is worldliness? What does it mean to love the world? Now we're going to think first about the word world. If we're not to love the world, what is meant by world? And then we'll think about what it means to love. If we're not to love the world, what is meant by love? So first thinking about the word world, and then the word love, and then put it together. So what is meant by world in this context? Well, often it's helpful to start with what John is not talking about. So John is not talking about the world in the sense of nature or creation or even our pleasure-filled response to what he's made. So the Bible actually celebrates the goodness and glory of God in our material world. The Bible actually encourages us to take great delight in what God has made. So ancient King David sings, "The heavens proclaim God's glory." The terrifyingly beautiful angels in Isaiah 6, they're singing, "Holy is the Lord, the whole earth is full of his glory." The wise preacher in Ecclesiastes goes so far as to put it like this, "I know there's nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their work. That is the gift of God." Ecclesiastes 3. So John's not talking about the physical world, and he's not talking about our enjoyment of it. Neither is John talking about people. And a previous book that John has written, the Gospel of John, chapter 12, verse 19, a group of religious radical, we'll say fundamentalists, named Pharisees, are seeing Jesus' popularity, and they respond, "There's nothing we can do. The whole world," same word, "has gone out after him." I think we use that word in the similar ways. We talk a sporting event like the Super Bowl or maybe the Olympics, and we say the whole world will be watching. John's not talking about people, nor is he even talking about people in their sins who are hostile to God. That's why he records those famous words in John 3:16. "For God so loved the world." What he means is he loved the world in opposition to himself. God so loved hostile enemies that he gave his only son. And aren't you glad that God loved the world, that he gave his son to die for the sins of people like you and me? Sometimes people express amazement that God would actually judge sin and condemn people. But that's like being amazed that a judge actually sentences criminals, isn't it? The real amazement is that God sent his only son to die for criminals like you and me. Beloved, does the grace of God, does his grace amaze you? God did not send his son into a world of criminals to condemn them, but that the world of criminals through his son might be saved. Who is like our God in forgiveness and pardon? Friends, I pray that if you don't know this God, that you would call out to him today and place your hope in him. There's no one like him. So John's not talking about the material world. He's not talking about our response of enjoyment, people in general, even evil people. So what's he talking about? Well, it refers to an entire outlook in life, an organized system of values and actions that are in the end opposed to God, an organized system of values and attitudes. So here's some definitions from other writers. This is worldly attitudes or values that are opposed to God. An Anglican minister, John Stott from the United Kingdom, observes that in this context, world means an evil system organized under the dominion of Satan. So it's referring to the life of human society, an organized outlook on life, an entire worldview of attitudes and actions and morals and its ways of thinking. We use the word world like this. We can talk about the world of sports, the world of politics, the world of banking. There's a whole set of attitudes and expected behaviors and the like that go along with that world. That's what John's saying here. He's telling us not to love the world. He means don't be enchanted, don't be drawn in to an organized system of values and attitudes, to an outlook on life that lives without reference or reverence for God. Don't love worldly attitudes and values. That's what's meant by world. So let's think about love, and that won't take long. He means by love, don't set your heart on, don't set your affections, don't be identified or defined by the attitudes and values of this world. So don't orient your life around the value and visions of this organized way of looking at life. And the most common way, the most deadly way that the world looks at life is this way. They look at life without God. So don't fall in love with thinking of life without reference or reverence for God. That's why it's called worldliness, because it's living with this world only in mind. It's living without reference, without reverence for God. So that's worldliness. And now he's saying, don't orient your life around those goals and values of the world's ways. Don't do it. Don't let your heart be drawn into it. If you put these both together, here's a really simple way to put the command to love, not the world, is to hate the things that God hates and love the things that God loves. The important thing in that both definition is God. Love what God loves. Hate what God hates. That's the command. And this command is in a sense, you know, John waving his wand. It's his attempt to cast a counterspell to open our eyes to the enchantment of worldliness that we're in. And now we're ready for the second major question. The first one, what is it to love the world? What's worldliness? Here's the second one. What does worldliness, what does love for the world look like? Well, the short answer, if you have your Bible open, is verse 16. It means worldliness is not to have your life dominated by three things. What are they? Verse 16. Don't have your life dominated by the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, or the pride of life, or the pride of one's possessions. The New Living Translation brings out the desire, the craving for physical pleasure, a craving for everything we see, and pride in our achievements and possessions. Do those cravings describe the direction of your life this morning? In any way? If so, you're worldly. Stop loving the world. Now, before we look at each of those three categories, let's just step back for a moment and think about them collectively. We mentioned earlier that the Bible commands us to enjoy creation and take delight in it. But at first glance, that might sound like we're to do something that's here forbidden in this text. So how can we resolve any tension between enjoying the created world and not loving it? Well, here's the simplest way that I know how to put it. We've stated it before. It's loving and living for things without reverence for God. That's what it is. I even think, kids, and your order of worship, right there in the middle, I think Miss Layla's given a very helpful way to look at this as well. Here's what she gives as a definition. God has given us many wonderful things in this world to enjoy, but the problem comes when we love those things more than we love God. That's it. So, what are you tempted to love more than God? Or to put that in the context, if we set this now in the context of 1 John 2, what are you tempted to love more than God's commands? What are you tempted to love more than Jesus? That's the flow of the text. Let's come at it from another way. Here's how one study guide for 1 John I came across put it like this. I found it helpful. This is taking the good things of God and using them in a way they were never meant to be used. The problem of worldliness occurs when we don't receive God's gifts with thanksgiving and enjoy them as he intended. We misuse God's good gifts. That's worldliness. What do you know what that looks like? Here are some examples. If the gift of wine is used for drunkenness, if the gift of material things becomes extravagance, if the gift of sexuality is used for immorality, if the gift of work is used for power, we've misused God's good thing and we're worldly. That's what loving the world is. You see, as soon as we assign a value to things God doesn't assign a value to, whenever we pursue purposes for our lives not in keeping with God's purposes, whenever we enjoy things without giving thanks to God, we're loving the world. Do you see how easy it is to do? Do you see it in your life? Anywhere? Well, if not, now let's dig now a little deeper by looking at these categories. See what it looks like. First, here's one category it operates in. The lust of the flesh, the cravings for physical appetites and pleasures. Do you remember the first temptation in the Bible? Did God say, "You shall not eat"? Well, do you hear the appeal? It's at one level an appeal to the physical appetites, to natural human desire. Again, God is for pleasure. He's given us eyes to see the colors of spring. He's given us taste buds to enjoy an infinite variety of taste combinations. He's given sex drives for marital enjoyment, emotions for game-winning shots in March Madness. Those are all from God. But now here's a deep craving, a craving so deep, here it is, a craving so out of order that one is willing to pursue pleasure without regard for God. And the drive for pleasure, for appetites, are so strong that sometimes we mistake the desire for truth. So I've sat across the table from married men who've told me, "One woman cannot satisfy me. God made me this way." Well, do you see that's living for the lust of the flesh without regard for God? Another angle, it's letting our entire humanity be reduced to a physical appetite. It's actually dehumanizing to reduce your life to cravings for appetites. Isn't that what happens in the life of a drug user? They give in to the cravings of the flesh. So often, they start to become unhuman. I don't recognize them anymore. They've become Gollum. Now, you've seen this in others, but do you see it in yourself? Is your drive for sex taking you places God doesn't intend? Are you letting a world's value system shape your sexual identity? Is your drive for pleasure affecting your work and family life? Are you growing careless, cavalier in your drinking? The places that you go? Oh, stop loving. Stop it. Listen, I think we're well aware of, you know, the benefits and often necessities of being on a diet for and from certain foods. Do you think that our emotions and feelings and pleasures, that other appetites, also need the helpful discipline of a diet too? Yeah, and John's saying, some things you just cut it out of your life. Cut it out. Second, think of the lust of the eyes, the cravings for what you see. The first is a craving for what we feel and we want. The second is now a craving for things that we see with our eyes. This is good old-fashioned covetousness. Whatever I see, I have to have. It's also the second temptation that Eve faced. The first, did God say you couldn't eat? But what comes next, immediately on the heels, Eve was convinced she saw that the tree was beautiful and its fruit looked delicious. I wonder if you see how enticing, can I put it this way, wise and crafty Satan is? We think temptation will always come wrapped in filth and smut. But most times it comes at us wrapped in bacon. Temptation comes at us, you know, wrapped in beauty, in intellectual appeal. Listen, Thomas Brooks, the old Puritan, writes the precious remedies against Satan devices, and he says that one of Satan's most common devices is he loves to paint vices with virtue's colors. Something ugly looks very beautiful. So, I'm not overworking. I'm providing a better living for my family. I'm not anxious. I'm just concerned. It's not an affair. It's just a friendship. It's not unforgiving. I just want justice. Do you see? That's appealing to the beauty of something when it's ugliness beneath. Or he also says that Satan is a master fisherman and he loves to show us the bait and hide the hook. And that's what happened to Eve. The apple was indeed undeniably so beautiful and it looked delicious. That's true. It wasn't false beauty there. But the sting of death was inside of it. That's what did in Achan when he saw a beautiful robe from Babylon. That's what did in David when he looked at Bathsheba when she bathed. And in the end, one old writer puts it like this. This is the love of beauty divorced from the love of goodness. That's really helpful. The love of beauty, you only have beauty if you have goodness with it. So here's beauty with no goodness. So what beauty are you coveting that's divorced from goodness? That can be a person, a relationship, a car, or a position at work. Your eyes want something so deeply that you're willing to lie like Achan, self-justify like David. Is it what you're watching? Is it what you're entertaining yourself with? Is it an account, a set of clients you've set your eyes on? Stop loving the world. Stop living for the cravings of what you see. Now the pride of life. It literally is life. It's bios at the end. And it comes out pride in our achievement, pride in our possessions, the pride of things in this life. So the first category of worldliness, I think, is finding identity in our desires, the cravings of the flesh. The second category of worldliness is finding identity in what we see and want, the lust of our eyes. And now this one is finding your identity in what we do and achieve and how we want to be perceived. It's the pride of possessions, the pride of status. It's the pride of a good performance review. And it's the last temptation that Eve faced. The tree was seen to make one wise. By way of self-evaluation, one writer puts it like this, an old commentator named Bruce, if my reputation, my public image, matters more to me than the glory of God, then I'm loving the world. Now listen, man, this got me good. That little line, because do you know, this pride of life is one of the reasons why we don't share the gospel more. It's the pride of life. We don't want to be thought of poorly in the eyes of others at some level. Isn't that true? I mean, I know we say it's out of respect for others that we don't share, but often it's really fear, isn't it? At some level, it's the pride of life. But listen, what's really the worst thing that could happen if you started talking to people about Jesus? What's the worst thing that could happen? You're kind of mocked? I mean, a little scolding maybe? Maybe some relational distance from your neighbor. Oh, but can't we bear just a little scorn for Christ? Can you bear just a little for Him? We often don't witness because we're full of the pride of life. You see, this pride of life, of possessions, of positions, shows up whenever we base our significance in anything we do or how we're viewed. So here's the key. When I define myself to others in terms of my degrees, when I define myself as a pastor based on how the church is doing, when I define myself to others by my annual income, the importance of my clients, how behaved my students make me look at school, how my position in the company makes me appear, the kind of work that I do, the moment I let myself be defined by that and make that my business card to others, I've succumbed to what John calls the pride of life. I mean, don't you see, just from these three, it can show up anywhere in our life. It shows up in our careers and our entertainment and our houses and our relationships and our witnessing. Did you know that the Bible says it can even show up in your prayers? I mean, we tend to think worldliness is only really bad things, but worldliness shows up all over. Here's where James says worldliness shows up. James chapter 4, you ask for things in prayer, but you don't receive them. Why? Have you ever thought of this? Because you ask with wrong motives so that you may spend it on your pleasures. There it is. Worldliness shows up in our prayers, and then we say God's not good when He doesn't give it to us. Oh, how twisted the human heart is. How self-deceived that we are. We're more sinful than we realize, aren't we? We're under its spell in ways we're not even aware. And this is what's insightful. In describing worldliness, John is telling us where the real problem lies. We often define worldliness again by really bad things or as externals, don't we? So worldliness is something external. It's the movie industry. It's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's that job environment. It's my spouse. Whatever it is, it's something external outside of me. But John goes far deeper than that. He identifies our main problem is our cravings, our desires, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Our problem then is not the external world, but it's the internal world of our hearts that he's after. Our root problem then is disordered loves, not our world. That's where the problem is. Our affections, can I put it colloquially, are all out of whack. I mean, remind yourselves, where did Jesus say evil comes from? Where? Push aside every other secondary cause. Where does it come from? Doesn't it come from your own heart? Our problem is that we crave the wrong things in the wrong order, with the wrong emphasis, and worst of all, we want them without regard for God or without reverence for what He said. This is far deeper, far worse, far more serious than we realize. It's like a cancer that's spreading all over the body, and now it's affecting things from our sexual desires to our prayer life to our career goals. It's just everywhere. Do you see it? You know what it means? This isn't simply about changing a few behaviors. What we need is what the Bible calls a new heart. a new set of desires. We need to be born again. And to stop loving the world means sometimes there are desires that speak to you that sound like truth, and you're going to have to strangle them. Put to death what's earthly in you. Have you ever felt that struggle? That's exactly what it feels like. Stop loving the world. Strangle it. Mortify it. Die to yourself. Because if you don't, it will kill you forever. We need so desperately to be born again. And if we've been born again, we need constant renewal. Like what? Like Romans 12. We need the mercies of God filling our gaze so that we will stop being conformed to the world and transformed by the renewing of our mind. There's the spell being undone. How do you break the spell? You renew your mind with gospel reality. You see, only His love then poured into our hearts from the cross can break the spell of worldliness in our hearts. There's got to be a greater love to break this one, and there is. So are you looking at the cross? Do you see Him on the tree? Do you hear Him groaning? Because from the cross, He's casting a spell of redeeming love as He lets out His last breath to break the enchantment of worldliness. Keep looking at the cross, and you'll see your worldliness on display. You'll see your forgiveness being granted, and you'll see your true self being given back to you. So, here's what we have so far. A command to stop loving the world. We're to hate what God hates and love what He loves. And this passage shows us what worldliness is. It's taking the good things of God and using them in a way He never meant for them to be used. Well, that leads to a third big question. Why should we avoid worldliness? Why should we avoid loving the world? And John gives, I'll call them three reasons here. Reason number one is at the end of verse 15. Here's the first reason not to love the world. Because if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Now, John's basically restating Jesus' words in the Gospels that we read together collectively earlier in the service. You can't serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money. You can't serve God and the world. Listen to how clearly and how strongly James puts it. You adulterous people, don't you realize that friendship with the world makes you an enemy of God? I say it again, if you want to be a friend of the world, you make yourself an enemy of God. Do you love the world? Why? Don't love the world. Because you cannot love the world and love the Father at the same time. Are you God's friend or God's enemy? The second reason, and the third, are down in verse 17. Here's the second reason. The world is passing away along with its desires. Now that word desires, it's the same word He uses in the phrases lust or craving to the flesh and of the eyes. That, in other words, those desires that you're living for that are animating you and giving you purpose, those cravings that you're pursuing, that worldly system of life, it's all going to pass away. They won't deliver on the promises they give. That the worldly set of values, the worldly set of attitudes that seem more real to you right now than Jesus, they're actually passing away. One commentator puts it like this. That means they've already begun to putrefy. They're a corpse not yet buried. Now that's similar to what C.S. Lewis said in his Weight of Glory address. That it's a mistake to take the good things of life and treat them as ends in themselves. And if you do that, the good things will just break your heart. They'll just destroy you. It's similar, again, referencing the David Foster Wallace commencement address, who said, when you worship beauty, you'll always feel that you're ugly. When you worship your intelligence, you'll feel like you're not smart enough. When you pursue pleasure for pleasure's sake, it'll turn you into a user. The world, with its lust, it's just a corpse. And recently, I know many of you do as well, but recently, I feel like I'm surrounded by people dying. Some that I know and some that I don't know. You know, Ron's dad passed away with the battles of Alzheimer's. Ryan's grade school teacher passed away. My brother-in-law's dad passed away. A long battle with cancer. A few weeks ago, our missionary Tim Bixby's dad had a heart attack after one of his sermons and died. Our congregation has experienced a miscarriage. Last week, I had a friend staying with our and his family staying with us for several days, whose brother was killed in an accident on 85, changing a tire. And as I left the funeral service this past week with the afternoon sun in the parking lot, I thought, this world with its desires, it's passing away. And I may, at my relatively middle-aged life now, be on my way for more funerals than I am for marriages. The things that we crave most won't be there when your time comes. It won't help you. Don't love the world. Why? It's all passing away. It's a corpse not yet buried. The third reason is at the end of verse 17, and this is a positive reason. Stop loving the world because the one who does the will of God abides forever. So in keeping with this theme, John insists that belief in God shows up in transformed conduct. Do you see that? He insists that to believe in God is to do the will of God. Beloved, that's one of the reasons why we have a church covenant, that our belief in God must show up in our behavior. And John says that the one who's doing the will of God, that's the one who's not loving the world. It's the one who loves Jesus. It's the one who keeps his commands. And yes, that person is the one who will abide forever. Again, we always have to be careful. He's not talking about our works saving us. But he's saying that doing the will of God is evidence that our hearts have been forgiven and that we're eager to respond to grace with love. So don't love the world because you can't love the world and love the Father. You're either God's friend or God's enemy. Don't love the world because its desires and the world are passing away. And don't love the world because the one who does the will of God will endure, abide, remain forever. So we've seen what it is, what it looks like, why we should avoid it. And now the last point. How do we fight it? We've been given hints throughout the message. I just want to give us two ways. Gaze at the consequences and gaze at the cross. Fight it by looking at the consequences means a lot of things, but here's just one. It means thinking again and again about the reasons we just mentioned. So, for example, to love the world will make me an enemy God. Is that safe? To love the world means I will set my hope on things that won't finally deliver me. Is that what I want? To love the world is to set my heart on things that are passing away. Think about the consequences of setting your hope on something that's fake. The horror suspense writer Stephen King kind of experienced this a little while ago. I think he was riding a bike or a walk on a familiar stretch of road and he was struck by a vehicle. And here's his reflection. A couple of years ago, I found out what you can't take it with you means. I found out while I was lying in a ditch at the side of a country road, covered with mud and blood, and the tibia of my right leg poking out the side of my jeans like a branch of a tree taken down in a thunderstorm. I had a MasterCard in my wallet, but when you're lying in a ditch with broken glass in your hair, no one accepts a MasterCard. We all know that life is ephemeral. But on that particular day and in the months that followed, I got a painful but extremely valuable look at life's backstage truths. We come in naked and broke. We may be dressed when we go out, but we're just as broke. Warren Buffett, going to go out broke. Bill Gates, going out broke. Tom Hanks, going out broke. Stephen King, broke. Not a crying dime. All the money you can earn, all the flings that you can have, all the stocks to buy, all the mutual funds you trade, all of that is smoke and mirrors. No matter how large your bank account, no matter how many credit cards you have, sooner or later things will begin to go wrong. Think of the consequences. There is a way that seems right to a man, but the end leads to death. The other consequences you could think about, but we'll move to the second way. Fight it by looking at the cross. When you gaze at the cross, you know what you're seeing? You're seeing the outcome of your desires writ large. That's where they lead. You're seeing the consequences of your sins. To love the world leads to a bleeding, shredded piece of human flesh hanging on a tree. Do you see it? Thus, John Newton writes in his hymn, "The cross displays my sin for all the world to view." So, here's how you fight it. Can you pursue your sexual sin, your lust of the flesh, while hearing his agonized cries on the cross? Can you pursue your covetousness, lust of the eyes, when the blood from the crown of thorns runs down into his eyes? Can you pursue possessions and position when you see that his throne is a cross? Gaze at the cross. Gaze at the horror of the cross to break the enchantment of worldliness. Not only the horrors and consequences, but again, even in gazing at the consequences, what we're gazing at is the love of the cross. That the love of Christ casts a better spell, a deeper spell, a more lasting spell than the love of the world. Do you see? Think of Jesus' life. We thought of Eve. Now think of Jesus. Do you see that when he was tempted to give into the lust of the flesh, that he resisted? Luke 4, Satan said, "Turn these stones into bread and eat them." But he didn't. Do you see when Jesus is tempted to give into the lust of the eyes? He resisted. Satan showed him, he says, the kingdoms of the world. And he says, "Look at them. Worship me and I'll give you everything that you see." There's the temptation, but he didn't. Do you see that when Jesus was tempted to give into the pride of life, he resisted? Satan said, "Hurl yourself down from the temple and you're so important that the angels will come and help you." But he didn't. At the cross, Jesus refused to love the world. And the world hated him for it. He resisted every temptation. He loved not the world so that our love for the world could be forgiven, so the spell of worldliness could be broken. When you look at the cross, see, the flow of the context is all of those gospel realities we looked at last week, that's what's flowing into my heart. I don't need the love of the world because I'm loved by the Father. I don't need possessions to make myself feel significant because I've been forgiven, and that's my identity. I don't need pleasures apart from God. I don't even have to let them define me because I've overcome them by the blood of the Lamb. You see, the only way to break this spell is to come under the power of his love at the cross. You've got to look at those gospel realities from the previous verses again and again and again and again. Someone has said, because here's what's at stake, worldliness is so serious because Christ is so glorious. What's at stake in loving the world is not a moral life free of STDs and whatever else. No, 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 no. What's at stake is eternal joy and a new heaven and new earth with Christ forever. That's what's at stake. Worldliness is serious because Christ is so glorious. So see the consequences and see the cross. And gaze at his love until it comes into your heart and changes you at every level.